This is 1A. It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. In the space of a week, thousands of people go from mourning a general to protesting the regime in Iran. Also, the entire Russian government resigns. China and America take a step back from an all-out trade war. And we learned a lot more about President Trump's efforts to put the screws on Ukraine's president and the work of his lawyer to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and his son Hunter. My guests are Ann Garin, White House correspondent with a focus on foreign policy and national security at The Washington Post. Ann, great to have you back.
Happy to be here.
James Kitfield is senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. He's a contributing writer for Atlantic Media and author of Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. James, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Also, Robbie Grammer, he's diplomacy and national security reporter at Foreign Policy. Robbie, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're all here. I want to start in Iran and the Middle East. Thousands of people in the streets protesting across Iran this week after the government acknowledged that it had accidentally shot down a passenger plane, killing 176 people on board. Demonstrators faced tear gas and accused security forces in Iran of firing live ammo at them as they ran through the streets of Tehran. Now, Iran denied the use of live ammunition even after video from the Center for Human Rights seemed to show a protester shot in the leg. And give us a quick summation of what led to all of this, in case listeners haven't been following the news. What happened to this jetliner, and why are protesters in the streets now?
Well, Todd, the protest changed from one that was, as you said in your intro, primarily one in support of the government, a national show of mourning over the U.S. strike that had killed top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani a week and a half ago. When the Iranian government quite unexpectedly acknowledged what multiple Western governments had already said, which is that they had shot down a Ukrainian jetliner near the Tehran airport on the night of the airstrikes, that protest very quickly shifted, and it became one that was very anti-government and has proved extremely difficult for the Iranian government to manage. And this is not the first time we've had mass protests in the streets. They've been happening every few months, but they have not been either as vociferous, as completely directed straight at the leadership, and the idea that it just quickly turned on such a dime gives a view to how strong the Iranian street feeling is, that their government messed up here. Their government is not able to handle this situation.
James, give me a sense of what is driving people into the streets. Look, it's not safe to protest in Iran beyond a certain point, especially not against the government. People angry that they were lied to about what downed this jet. Is there more behind it?
Iran is reeling right now, so there's a lot of general unrest that the economy's in the tank because of our maximum pressure campaign of sanctions. They're in this escalation. They've climbed this escalation ladder with the United States to just one rung below actual all-out war with the United States. I mean, we found out just in the last 24 hours, 11 U.S. service members are being treated for concussions because they were so close to this missile strike that Iran launched after, you know, tit for tat, we killed Soleimani. I maintain, and I've talked to senior military officials on this, that if they had killed Americans in that strike, we'd have had no choice but to attack Iran territory because that's where those missiles came from. So we're on a razor's edge of tension with this country right now. The populace obviously is very concerned about this, and quite honestly, I'm quite concerned about it too, because as I said, we're one rung from all-out war with Iran. We've now stepped back a little bit because I think both sides realize how close it is, but we have not climbed back down. There's no off-ramp yet to this escalating fight we're doing with Iran right now.
It seems clear that protesters in Iran, Robbie, feel that they weren't told the truth by their government about the downing of that jet accident clearly an accident, but human error from inside the government. But James raises the issue of 11 Americans injured in the attacks that we talked about last week, of course, in retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani. 11 injured directly contradicts what the president said after the attacks, which is no deaths and no injuries. Was this an attempt to maintain de-escalation, do you think, that we won't talk about injuries because it helps us not have to attack Iran? Or was it something more sinister of the president not wanting to acknowledge that American personnel were wounded?
Well, the news just broke this morning about the 11 American service members being wounded, some being taken back to Germany for further medical treatment. So we don't know exactly what yet. But what was clear in the initial aftermath is that the president does have a trust problem. I mean, if he lies about the little things in, you know, major international crises like this, for some lawmakers, for some in the American public, it's difficult to know if what the government says is really true here. I think we'll see, as we see more information come out, we'll learn more about the play-by-play of when the Pentagon, when the White House knew about these injuries. But it is true. I mean, in the initial aftermath, when Trump was calling for de-escalation with Iran, saying all is well, thankfully no American service members were hurt, we now know that not to be true.
And the Ayatollah Khamenei led prayers on Friday. Now, that's extremely rare in Iran. My understanding is that he hasn't led prayers publicly for 8 years. Is that significant? Does that show a supreme leadership and an Iranian government nervous about their appearance in front of the public?
Short answer, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it has been 8 years since Khamenei has taken the podium or the lectern or the, I actually don't know the correct term for the National Friday prayers, and it is maybe the clearest marker we've had yet that he himself feels that the regime is, if not under threat, at least under considerable stress from within. And it, you know, the usual default on the part of all Iranian leaders is that it is the United States' fault, and that clearly is the main argument he's making to his own people. But the fact that he's making it himself is extremely significant. I will say one thing on the 11. CENTCOM actually put out a statement on this last night, which was, you know, in CENTCOM style, like, four sentences long and extremely brief. It was absolutely the first time anyone had heard any indication that there had been American troops transported for treatment. The statement indicated that had happened sometime after. It wasn't specific, but it appeared that it was some days after the airstrike. So it is possible that in the initial aftermath, those injuries might not have been clear.
Now, speaking of Iran and the message during all of this, the State Department suddenly canceled two classified congressional briefings on U.S.-Iranian relations. Those meetings were supposed to touch on, among other things, embassy security and other issues as well. Staff and lawmakers are apparently, James, furious about it on the Hill. Lawmakers do not like when they feel like the administration is hiding the ball on something.
I mean, this is a severe national crisis we're in. We're on the edge of a war with a major country, and the State Department won't even brief the Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate. It's unheard of. And it gets to Robbie's point about whether you can trust what President Trump says. President Trump had said that he killed Soleimani because four American embassies were under imminent threat. His own defense secretary said, well, I didn't see that intelligence. So there's this gulf, and the guys at the State Department know exactly that when they come up to Congress, even though it was a classified briefing, they were going to be put on the line about it. So who's right here? What was the actual situation? It is a crisis when the commander-in-chief can't be trusted in something as important as war and peace. And that's kind of what we're seeing. And no one wants to, in his administration and his cabinet, wants to get out of the lane where they're contradicting what the president says.
Well, it's a crisis if the president's words can't be trusted. It's another thing altogether if the president's words are just angry and you don't want to get out of your lane. James, I'm glad you brought this up, because speaking of Hill briefings, we learned this week that intelligence officials lobbied on Capitol Hill to cancel annual public threat assessment hearings that are a tradition on Capitol Hill. And the reason they want them canceled is because it makes President Trump so angry when his intel chiefs contradict his pronouncements and his tweets in public, Robbie.
Yeah, and I, you know, this obviously gets back to everything we've been talking about. I think what's important here is that obviously the intelligence community operates behind the scenes outside of public eyes. So having this annual threat assessment in public is really one of the public's only chance to be able to hear from the senior members of the U.S. intelligence community on what they're seeing, what they're hearing, how they assess those national security threats around the world. So there's been a lot of outcry on Capitol Hill from lawmakers already about potentially canceling or bringing back into secret this type of briefing. And I think we're going to see yet another battle between the executive branch and legislative branch here over transparency, over what can be in public, over what can be in private, which you know, goes back to almost every foreign policy issue that we've been covering.
And what did you make of this? It doesn't take a lot to want to drive the intel chiefs into private. That's where they prefer to be, not out in public. But their pitch to Capitol Hill is it just makes the president too mad. And like James says, we don't want to be out of our lane.
Right. I mean, these hearings are supposed to be on February 12th, one in the House, one in the Senate. It's an annual ritual where we actually get to see the DNI, who's like not a very public figure. The rest of it will be in private. We do not expect the committees to grant this request. We do expect to see the DNI and others on the 12th.
And I expect to see tweets. That's what I expect. It's the Friday News Roundup. Our guest this week, Ann Garin of The Washington Post, James Kitfield, Senior Fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and Robbie Grammer, Diplomacy and National Security Reporter at Foreign Policy. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stick with us. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. It's the Friday News Roundup on 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Here with me this week are Ann Garin of The Washington Post, James Kitfield, Senior Fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and Robbie Grammer, Diplomacy and National Security Reporter at Foreign Policy. We were talking about Iran and the Supreme Leader, the Ayatollah, just before the break, and we got this tweet from Nick. The name for the place where a speaker stands in a mosque akin to a pulpit or a podium is called a minbar. Good. We got it. A midbar.
Fantastic.
Which is where the Ayatollah stood, as you mentioned, to try to reestablish his authoritarian role, I think, and his message of dominance over Iranian society during this week of protests.
Learn Great. Something new every day.
Knowledge. And I love it when listeners get in and make sure that we know these things. Minbar. Now I have it and I won't forget it. We found out earlier today that U.S. forces have now resumed joint anti-ISIS operations with Kurdish Iraqi forces, speaking of the neighborhood there. It's the first since operations were suspended in Iraq 2 weeks ago. And for the first time, Robbie, foreign policy played a big role in the Democratic presidential debates this week in Des Moines. Candidates talked a lot about Iran. They talked a lot about foreign policy, I think, for the first time in pretty significant detail.
Yeah, at long last, we get some foreign policy in the debates.
You had something to file after.
Exactly, exactly. It was pretty great. It was interesting because the first part of that debate that focused on foreign policy, it felt like it was a throwback to 2003 when they were relitigating who supported the war in Iraq. And I think that goes to this broader question where there's a real debate among the Democratic candidates about America's role in the world that you might not have seen in past presidential elections, this existential question of, you know, where and when we use the military. Nearly everyone agrees that, you know, we need to get out of these costly wars in the Middle East, but past presidents have said that, and look where we are now. We're still there. So it was really interesting. One interesting thing I took note of there when they were talking about North Korea is former Vice President Joe Biden saying he would not get into negotiations with North Korea without preconditions. And we haven't heard a lot from the other candidates on the ongoing nuclear negotiations with Trump that seem to go in fits and starts with the North Korean leader.
Biden has this credibility on national security issues, former chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, vice president with a big portfolio. Nobody thinks he doesn't know what he's talking about, and yet voted for the Iraq war, which is the number one mark against you if you're a Democratic candidate, especially with this progressive Democratic Party. On the other hand, the other candidates in the race don't have much experience on any of these issues at all. Bernie says, I voted against it. Okay, you voted against it. You called that one right, according to Democrats. This difference, how is it playing out? Is this playing for Biden, do you think, if national security becomes a significant issue in this campaign? I don't know that it will.
Well, I think, yeah, he'll have to deal with the ghosts of his past. I think his opponents will keep harping on the 2003 Iraq war vote. But other candidates have put forward substantive, even if they lack the experience Biden has put forward substantive foreign policy platforms, real tangible policy proposals. For example, Pete Buttigieg talked about having a 3-year sunset clause on future congressional authorizations for the president to carry out war or with his war making abilities in the future. And that's a big debate between Congress and the president right now, both with the war in Yemen and also this almost war that we had with Iraq. What role does the president have, and does he need prior congressional approval to send troops or carry out military actions that could spark war?
And there appear to be the votes in the Senate to restrain the president in Iran, and we'll be watching that too if that ever comes up in the Senate. Let's talk about what Fiona Hill previously referred to as a domestic political errand. Let's talk about Ukraine. We found out more about President Trump's efforts to use his personal lawyer to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and his son in Ukraine. Lev Parnas, an indicted associate of Rudy Giuliani, turned over a whole trove of documents and photos and texts to Congress this week. He's since been speaking out a lot. Here's Parnas on CNN laying out the message that he took to Ukraine's new president and what the consequences would be if President Zelensky did not go public on his intention to open an investigation into Hunter Biden.
If they didn't make the announcement, basically, there would be no relationship. It was no specific military. There was no aid that was going to be assisted. There was going to be no inauguration. Pence wouldn't be at the inauguration. And there would be no visit to the White House. There would be basically, they would have no communication.
How did you have the authority to say the vice president of the United States will not attend the inauguration if you don't do what I say?
I mean, that's what I was told to do.
Who told you to do that?
Rudy Giuliani.
James, from where you sit, what is the significance of Lev Parnas, with all of his liabilities, indicted Lev Parnas, coming forward and giving this firsthand account of what he says was the operation in Ukraine at the behest of Rudy Giuliani and at the behest of the president?
It gets very hard to make this argument, which we've heard from some of Trump's defenders, that basically Giuliani was freelancing and that this was just a couple of guys who were out there, you know, doing things that the president wasn't aware of. There's in the text that they turned over and some of the documents, it's very clear that Rudy Giuliani refers to a number one is getting involved in whether he's going to lift a visa ban on a Ukrainian prosecutor who wanted to come to the States and trash the Bidens. It's pretty clear that this is all being directed by President Trump. It is, that's why Trump set Giuliani, his personal lawyer, on this errand, is because it was someone that he could deal with directly without having to go through a bureaucracy like the State Department, which you would normally do on things like this.
In other words, not U.S. policy, but the president's personal errand.
Exactly. And it just becomes, you know, he's got so much detail. He was in the room, you know, discussing this with senior Ukrainian officials. He was dealing directly with Giuliani. In some cases, he's had discussions with Trump. I mean, they can probably still say that this is hearsay because he's getting it from Giuliani. So until Giuliani actually, but Giuliani has said he kept President Trump in the loop constantly with what he was doing. So this has become increasingly clear that the president was at the center of this effort. And you can still argue that maybe it doesn't rise to an impeachable defense. Offense, but it certainly seems like President Trump was orchestrating this.
Now, and for his part, Ukraine's foreign minister says he's never met Lev Parnas, doesn't believe a word he's saying. Why should we believe him? First of all, are you surprised by that message coming from the government of Ukraine?
I'm I am a little bit. Parnas is not a he's not particularly friendly with the Zelensky government. He was friendlier with the previous government, the Poroshenko government, and met directly with Poroshenko. He says at the behest of in pursuit of this personal errand. The Zelensky government, remember, came in with a specific mandate to clean up corruption and to get rid of a lot of people who had been, at least at one point, associates of Parnas, who is an American but did a lot of work in that part of the world. So it is surprising a little bit that the government would say, like, a version of what Trump is saying, like, never met the guy, don't know who he is, no idea, but not especially surprising that they wouldn't be friendly to his point of view.
Now, for the president's part, he says, as he often does, and as you telegraph there, doesn't even know Lev Parnas, doesn't know anything about him, even though there are several photos and videos of them together. Here's a reminder from November 2019 about what the president knew about Giuliani's work in Ukraine. He was being interviewed by former Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly.
Giuliani's your personal lawyer. So you didn't direct him to go to Ukraine to do anything or put any heat on him?
No, I didn't direct him, but he is a warrior. Rudy's a warrior. Rudy went. He possibly saw some. I think he's done work in Ukraine for years.
It's not a whole lot of direct information in that Fox News quote, Robbie, but Lev Parnas says his work in Ukraine was for President Trump. It had nothing to do with corruption in Ukraine and everything to do with Joe Biden. Does this change anything? The Senate is hearing these facts now. Does this change anything about our understanding about the case and maybe about senators?
Well, I think one thing that the senators who are now going to be the jurors in the impeachment trial have to grapple with is Lev Parnas a credible witness? And the White House has already said this is a guy who's lying to, shore up his testimony to build his defense. Democratic lawmakers coming out and reacting with a lot of shock and seeming to take Parnas at his word. But remember, this is a guy who owned a company called Fraud Guarantee that paid Rudy Giuliani $500,000 in consulting fees, has operated these shady businesses in Eastern Europe for years, as Anne said. And so it's really difficult to say. It's just another twist and turn. One other thing I did want to highlight from these documents that Parnas turned over to Congress, there was this weird text exchange between him and a character who's sort of been on the periphery so far, a Republican congressional candidate in Connecticut, Robert Hyde, that appeared to show they were electronically or physically surveilling the former U.S. ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, whose career was derailed in the midst of this whole impeachment saga. And it's just it's difficult to assess whether these are outlandish claims, whether these are legitimate. But it's just another bizarre twist in this entire impeachment investigation.
James, the State Department so far has said nothing about the alleged surveillance of one of its ambassadors and current State Department employee Marie Yovanovitch in Ukraine. And now we learn, as we sit here, that the State Department now will investigate, the Secretary of State says, will investigate whether these private citizens, Lev Parnas and his cohort, Robert Hyde, actually had Marie Yovanovitch under surveillance, because the text messages that Parnas provided to Congress and that had become public, they're pretty menacing.
Right. And I think the Ukrainians themselves have announced that they're going to investigate whether there was surveillance. So this is a big deal. If you are secretly surveilling a U.S. ambassador, there's any number of laws that you probably have trampled over. This is a threatening thing. And what's happened, we do know that the Secretary Pompeo did was step aside as Giuliani launched this reputation trashing campaign against the ambassador, eventually having her pulled, and did nothing to support his own ambassador in Ukraine. So I think that he probably feels that he is in a very bad spot in terms of what to do about this surveillance charge. They have not backed up her at all, but we're going to find out, I think, probably new things that they were doing that made her life uncomfortable, and I think that'll play into the impeachment discussion.
Ileana says via Twitter, Parnas may think he has direct knowledge of President Trump's involvement, but I doubt he does. Would have to have spoken with the president and received clear instructions, not mafia speak. His contacts were all with Giuliani, who could contradict him and deny Trump's involvement.
Which is what I said. I mean, there will be those who say this is all hearsay. But again, Giuliani himself has said that the president was kept in the loop on all of his activities. So it's, you can decide yourself whether you think this is true or not. But it's true that he probably didn't get direct instructions from Giuliani was the cutout. He was the guy running the show. And Parnas was his interpreter. So he was in all those meetings. So what he says about Giuliani is not hearsay.
And?
Well, also, Parnas says that he was at a dinner at the Trump Hotel where the president attended. One of my colleagues described these dinners funded by the RNC at the Trump Hotel as a petri dish of bad ideas.
At the Colorful. Trump Hotel. Well, Vladimir Putin has ideas. Look, you can draw a line. If you want to spend a little bit of time drawing a line directly from this to Russia, you can. You want to draw it from Lev Parnas? Where did he get his money? From a guy named Viktor Firtash, who lives in Vienna, who is a businessman and also an oligarch and also a cutout for Russian for the Russian government. So I draw a line from Lev Parnas to Viktor Firtash, and I go straight to Vladimir Putin, because that's who I want to talk about next. It's a shakeup that a lot of people think is significant, as significant as the moment when Boris Yeltsin sent tanks into Moscow and shot at the parliament in 1993. There wasn't any hardware on display, but the entire government of Russia has resigned this week, including Prime Minister Medvedev, in a bid that appears to be, Robbie, Vladimir Putin cementing his position as president for life. How do we get from this resignation this week to the idea that Vladimir Putin says, despite the Constitution, I'm not going anywhere?
Yeah, it's a bit of a Russian constitutional jujitsu here, where he's working around the system and trying to reshape the system. In essence, after he said this, the entire government resigned, and the plan is a bit complicated, but the long and short of it is the parliament would be empowered, and Putin could come back in from being president to becoming prime minister to help stay in power. Many people, my colleague in Moscow has reported this, see this as a way in which he can eventually pick a successor, groom his successor, and phase out power, but for now remain in power regardless of what seat on paper he is in.
Opposition leader Alexei Navalny posted this tweet: the only goal of Putin and his regime is to stay in charge for life, having the entire country as his personal asset and seizing its riches for himself and his friends. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin appeared alongside his now former prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, on Wednesday, and the unfailingly loyal Medvedev sounded, I have to say, unfailingly loyal.
It is obvious that we, as a government of the Russian Federation, should provide the president of our country with the opportunity to make all the necessary decisions for this. In these conditions, I believe it would be right that, in accordance with Article 117 of the Constitution of the Russian Federation, the current government resigns.
And Dmitry Medvedev sounds very much like he's on board.
Yeah, well, Medvedev is sort of like the Mike Pence of the Russian government structure. He's the guy who sounds extremely reasonable and stands there and nods and has all the correct party ties and all the correct relationships with important constituencies, but basically answers to one person and one person only.
Sue writes this: Vladimir Putin wants to hold on to power, so he is finding his ways to do it. James, what's your read on this situation?
That's exactly right. I mean, and we've seen this show before. I mean, if you'll remember, Putin had to give up the presidency to Medvedev before he stepped in and was just a figurehead president. It was all the power was with Putin as a prime minister. He's just doing the same thing again. And, dictators and strongmen don't like giving up power. They never have and they never will.
Douglas writes, as soon as Vlad's massive oil and natural gas deals go through, he's out of there. What do you make of that? Now, I don't know that he has to be out of there. He's been getting money from gas and oil deals all along, in addition to every other sector of the Russian economy.
He's one of the richest men in the world, and we found that out from the Panama Papers. He's worth billions of dollars, and that didn't come from his salary.
And it didn't come from his years as a KGB operative or manager either. I don't think they were making that kind of dough.
No, they weren't.
And he is, say that again, one of the richest
men in the world.
In the world.
Yep.
A reminder, my guests at this table, and I'm so glad they're here, are James Kitfield, you just heard from. He's Senior Fellow Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. James is also author of Twilight Warriors, The Soldiers, the Spies, and Special Agents Who Are Revolutionizing the American Way of War. Robbie Grammer is here, diplomacy and national security reporter at Foreign Policy, and from The Washington Post, Anne Guerin. Stick with us. We're going to talk about China. We're going to talk about Sudan. And then we're going to spend a little bit of time, as we often do now on the Friday News Roundup, getting inside the heads of these journalists to find out what they're thinking about that maybe the rest of us aren't thinking about yet. Stay tuned for that. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. Back to the News Roundup with my guests, Anne Guerin of The Washington Post, James Kitfield, the senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and Robbie Grammer, diplomacy and national security reporter at Foreign Policy. Well, it made some pretty big news at the beginning of the week. Phase one of the U.S.-China trade deal was signed. As part of this deal, China has agreed to buy about $200 billion in U.S. products over the next 2 years. A floating estimate of how much of that will be U.S. agricultural products like soybeans and other products that we desperately want China to buy. The deal came just after a report by the NGO Human Rights Watch, which says the Chinese government is, quote, a global threat to human rights. We're going to talk about human rights, too. But first, James, what are the main features of this deal, which I will add phase one, not the whole deal? How big is phase one and how big of a deal is it?
Well, it was important. I think it's especially important for President Trump. He's in an election year now. He needs to show some progress on this years long back and forth with China on trade, where he's been slapping on tariffs and basically, you know, started a trade war. And now this is not ending the trade war, but it is sort of a pause in the trade war. China has agreed, as you said, to buy in the next couple of years roughly $200 billion of U.S. goods, agriculture as well as manufacturing. Has said some right things about intellectual property rights and not forcing people to do technology transfers who do business, companies that do business, U.S. companies that do business in China. But there's still $380 billion of trade between us and China that has tariffs slapped on it, and that will continue to drag on both countries' exporters. So it is a positive interim step. I think it was important for the president to do this at this time during election year. But President Trump wants credit for sort of putting out part of a fire that he started, and we'll see if the electric gives him that credit.
President Trump, you said at the top, needed this deal because it's an election year and he wants to post a win. That's not new. That makes perfect sense in politics. I get it. Did that decrease his leverage with China? The Chinese also know that he's up for re-election and that he needs a win. And as soon as you need something from the other guy, you don't have as much leverage as you had.
Well, and when we haven't gotten to the intellectual property rights is, and the technology transfers are really the core of what we object to about this trade relationship. And it remains unseen yet that there's enough enforcement in this to make a fundamental change. And one thing that we've asked the Chinese is to quit subsidizing their corporations, their state corporations, that we have to that our companies have to compete with. And there's no sign at all that they're going to agree to that. So it's a partial victory. But again, it's not the end of this trade war. It's just a pause in it.
And what did you see in the moment? What did you see in the timing of phase one and what it means?
A couple things. In the moment this week, President Trump appeared to be deliberately holding the Chinese delegation, in some form of diplomatic hostage for 35 minutes or roughly thereabouts, as they sort of stood and shifted around on their feet. And he went on and on and on in very political fashion. It didn't appear that the Chinese delegation thought that that's what they were there to do. So I thought that was a bit of showmanship that they probably did not welcome and weren't looking forward to. It also took a full day for the Chinese to release their version of the agreement. The government was silent on it in Beijing for quite a long period, and there was speculation that maybe the Chinese translation of this or the Chinese version of this would be considerably less binding than the one that the president said they had signed. That was not the case. The documents were identical. The one in Chinese and one in English are the same. They agree to the same things. I did think that President Trump needed to be able to say that he had finished this thing. Now, remember, this is what was phase one of what had originally been billed as an omnibus Chinese trade deal. I am the guy who is going to fix this giant problem that I inherited, and it's not my fault.
Tariffs are not a problem he inherited.
His argument was that that China was a problem he inherited, and he's the first guy to take it on, and he's going to take it on by making them come to their knees applying tariffs, and then we'll get what we get was his original plan here. He couldn't get that omnibus deal. Election is coming up. Yes, his leverage was declining. The Chinese knew that, but they wanted to get something on paper as well. So it ended up being mutually beneficial to bite off part of it and get that signed this year.
James, I mentioned the report from Human Rights Watch that China is a global human rights threat. I've asked this question before. Has the United States given up its leverage with China when it comes to human rights? There have been 1 million plus Uyghur Muslims in Western China thrown into re-education camps and detained. There was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, where a massive trade deal like this, any major transaction between the United States and China, would have human rights demands attached to it. Are there other places in negotiations where this is happening, or have we given up our leverage on that issue?
I have not seen any evidence that the Trump administration has put that on top of their priority list of human rights. And quite honestly, it is very difficult to change the domestic human rights activities of people through a trade deal. You're exactly right. And Human Rights Watch is exactly right, that China is a huge human rights abuser. As you said, more than 1 million Uyghurs in re-education camps. It has the most constrictive surveillance state in the world. Domestically, and they are exporting that technology to other authoritarian regimes so they can keep the thumb on their populaces. So China's a big problem, but I don't expect that problem to be solved by this trade deal.
All right, Robbie, I want to bring you in on Sudan, because on Tuesday, members of Sudan's security agency launched a rebellion from their base in Khartoum. Government forces crushed the rebellion after several hours of fighting and gunfire. 2 soldiers were killed, 4 were injured. The security agents are former elite troops who are loyal to ousted Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. Who are they, and what sparked this flare-up, this rebellion?
Well, keep in mind, Sudan just last year emerged from 30 years of a really brutal dictatorship under Bashir. And so this is the new transitional government. Sudan is in this very precarious, fragile position where it's trying to transition to democracy under a new Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok. And these soldiers were loyal to Bashir. I mean, there's 30 years of effectively, for lack of a better term, a deep state in Sudan right now that the new transitional government still has to deal with. These feared intelligence services and militaries who carried out heinous atrocities, even a genocide, they're still there even after the revolution. They haven't disappeared. So the rebellion was quashed. It still seems like there's a lot of support in Sudan right now for this democratic transition, but it's just another reminder of how precarious they are and how reliant they are on the United States to get out of this.
And I wanted to ask, how involved is the United States there now? In terms of troops, in terms of aid, in terms of diplomacy?
So it's a big aid recipient. The Prime Minister came to Washington last month where they announced that for the first time in over 2 decades, we were going to upgrade our diplomatic relations and exchange ambassadors. So the United States is offering these olive branches. We support democracy. But at the same time, Sudan is still under these really crippling international sanctions. And these people who carried out this revolution that ousted Bashir are really hungry to see quick change. So there's a closing window here where the United States and other countries that have sanctions on Sudan can lift these sanctions. But it's complicated. It's technocratic. It's not like the flip of a switch. So it's a really precarious situation.
And a ways to go on this road for Sudan, hopefully with the constructive help of the United States. I'd like to take a few minutes before we go here on the Roundup, since I have great journalists and experts here, to get inside your heads a little bit about stories that were maybe missing in the news, things you're working on or things that you think we should be thinking about that are maybe underreported or off the radar? Anne Guerin of the Washington Post, I'll start with you. What's in your notebook? What's on your screen that maybe I haven't seen?
Well, I don't know that it's underreported so much as that it's coming a little bit more clear. But next week, when on the very day that the impeachment trial begins in earnest on Tuesday, we know from the president's relatively definitive statement yesterday that he will actually be out of the country. He will be at Davos at the World Economic Forum gathering, which he attended 2 years ago. He skipped it last year because of the government shutdown, and pretty much everybody assumed he would skip it again this year because he wouldn't want to be away if either or both of a couple things were happening, if we were at war, fortunately we are not, or if he was in the middle of the impeachment trial. It seemed like not a thing he would want to do. However, the White House calculation has shifted in favor of have the president go meet with world leaders. Angela Merkel and others will be there as well. Do presidenty things, and that they'll make a split screen out of it, wherein he's on the other side of the world being president, and the proceedings in Washington are meant to look small by comparison.
The presidential optics of impeachment. I love how you describe that in terms of my television screen. It's probably more important than any of us would care to admit. James Kitfield, what about you?
I'm doing a project looking sort of a long term at this new era of great power competition that we're entering. We've heard echoes through this show about China and about Russia, but for almost half a century, we worked on the assumption that sooner or later we were trying to integrate these major powers into this liberal world order that we led, and that's failed. And so now we're in something that, to me, resembles a lot of the elements like the Cold War with both Russia and China. And we're not really prepared for that, and we need to start thinking long-term about strategies. Certainly China and Russia are thinking long-term about their strategy to undermine our leadership role, and we need to be thinking very seriously. One element that reminds me of the Cold War is this, we're entering almost a runaway nuclear weapons race again. The Trump administration got us out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. They are very wishy-washy about upgrading the START Treaty when it comes up for renewal in 2021, and all three countries have very aggressive modernization programs going with their nuclear arsenal. So I'm concerned about that, and I think we need to think long and hard about it.
There's something that concerns me about what you're saying. I think back to the Cold War. If we're returning to a Cold War posture, during the Cold War, we had an American-led international order through NATO, through other means, that formed this massive wall, this ballast against Russia and, to a lesser extent, Chinese influence. While this is going on, this new Cold War with Russia and China, our government is going about the business of dismantling that countervailing force that we had for 60 years.
That's exactly right. And also in Asia with, telling Korea, we're thinking about taking our troops out of there. We got to pay us five times more than you pay us now. The Trump administration's transactional approach has been very detrimental to a lot of our alliances, and instead of coming at a bad time.
Robbie Grammer, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is the Sahel. In West Africa, there has been a years-long effort by the French, U.S. international forces to push back terrorist groups they are affiliated with, al-Qaeda and ISIS, and the long story short is we are losing. These terrorist groups in Mali are spreading further south to other countries in Western Africa. And as this happens, the U.S. government just announced that they're trying to draw down our troop presence in Africa, which is causing a lot of alarm in African countries and in France that's been involved. While at the same time, the U.S. is trying to sort of ramp up its diplomatic presence. But I've spoken to U.N. officials about this who warn this could become the next Syria. I've spoken to former CIA analysts who say that these terrorist groups are more resilient and innovative than anything they've seen in their decades-long careers. So it's a very, very worrying trend in West Africa right now, and it seems to be a total blind spot with both the U.S. government and European governments now.
Four U.S. special forces were killed in Niger just a couple of years ago. That surprised a lot of Americans, not only the tragic death of those personnel, but also a wake-up call that we are active in shooting situations in places like Niger. Is that wake-up call connected to what you're talking about, the resurgence of al-Qaeda in places like Mali, places like Niger?
Yeah, absolutely. And we obviously, compared to, you know, the Middle East, we have a very limited troop presence there, and they're more in a special forces support, advise, train role. But the mission is, you know, these missions are uncertain now. We're talking about reorienting our military for this great power competition that that's been talked about to get ready to counter China or Russia in East Asia. So it's just another matter of limited resources and how do we balance all of these things. But it's a big concern among those watching it, and I'm not sure it has a lot of attention either in Washington or around the country right now.
Well, we need to go. It's time to say goodbye to the Friday News Roundup for another week. But before we do, I'll take you to Japan just for a moment. Something revolutionary happening in Japan. It's Environmental Minister Shinjiro Koizumi. He was the first person, he's a potential prime minister, by the way, he's rocking the societal boat, the first person to take parental leave a whole 2 weeks, the first person in the government. Japan offers new parents up to 1 year of parental leave, although only around 6% of men use this incentive. Koizumi told reporters, quote, "I struggled to work out how I could take paternity leave as well as fulfilling my public duty as environmental minister. We have to change not only the system, but also the atmosphere." New attention to parental leave in Japan. And Chris writes, he is eligible for a year of leave and it will only take 2 weeks. That's illustrative of how child rearing responsibilities are still disproportionately the burden of women, not only in Japan, but in a lot of other places as well. Thank you, Chris. You have the last word. Our sincere thanks to Anne Guerin of The Washington Post, to James Kitfield, Senior Fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and to Robbie Grammer, Diplomacy and National Security Reporter for Foreign Policy. Thanks to you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson, 1A senior producers are Paige Osborne and Danielle Knight. Remember, you'll find the 1A podcast more or less everywhere. You should know that the Friday News Roundup sounds just as good if you listen on Saturday. Doesn't have to be a Friday. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is 1A.